Like all the best love stories, it began in Paris. She was well known as a Hollywood actress and was actually an Illuminatus. He was becoming fairly famous as a jet-set millionaire and was actually a smuggler and anarchist. Envision Bogart and Bergman in the flashback sequences from Casablanca. It was like that, a passion so intense, a Paris so beautiful, recovering from the war it had been slipping toward in the Bogart-Bergman epic. A couple so radiant that any observer with an eye for nuance would have foretold a storm ahead. It came the night he confessed he was a magician and made a certain proposal to her. She left him at once. A month later, back in Beverly Hills, she realized that what he had asked her was her destiny. When she tried to find him, as often happened with Hagbard Chalene, he had dropped from public view, leaving his businesses in other hands temporarily, and was in camera. A year later, she heard that he was again a public figure, hobnobbing with English businessmen of questionable reputation and even more dubious Chinese import-export executives in Hong Kong. She violated her contract with the biggest studio in Hollywood and flew to the Crown Colony, only to find he had dropped from sight again, while his recent friends were being investigated for involvement in the heroin business. She found him in Tokyo, at the Imperial Hotel.
"A year ago, I decided to accept your proposal,"
she told him.
"But now, after Hong Kong, I'm not so sure."
"Thelema,"
he said, facing her across a room that seemed designed for Martians. It had actually been designed for Welshmen. She sat down abruptly on a couch.
"You're in the order?"
"In the order and against the order," he said. "The real purpose is to destroy them."
"I'm one of the top five in the United States,"
she said unsteadily.
"What makes you think I'll turn on them now?"
"Thelema,"
he repeated.
"It's not just a password, it means will."
"The order is my will,"
she quoted from Weishaupt's original oath of initiation.
"If you really believed that, you wouldn't be here,"
he said.
"You're talking to me because part of you knows that a human being's will is never in an external organization."
"You sound like a moralist. That's odd for a heroin merchant."
"You sound like a moralist, too, and that's very odd for a servant of Agarty."
"Nobody joins that lot,"
she said with a perk Cockney accent.
"Without being a moralist to start with."
They both laughed.
"I was right about you,"
Hagbard said.
"But,"
George interrupted,
"is he really in the heroin business? That's dirty."
"You sound like a moralist, too,"
she said.
"It's part of his demonstration. Any government could put him out of business within their borders, as England has done, by legalizing junk. So long as they refuse to do that, there's a black market. He won't let the mafia monopolize it. He makes sure the black market is a free market. If it wasn't for him, a lot of junkies who are alive today would be dead of contaminated heroin. But let me go on with the story."
They rented a villa in Naples to begin the transformation. For a month, the only humans she saw, aside from Hagbard, were two servants named Saad and Masak. She later learned that their real names were Eichmann and Callie. They began each day by serving her breakfast and quarreling. The first day, Saad argued for materialism and Masak for idealism. The second day, Saad expounded fascism and Masak communism. The third day, Saad insisted on cracking eggs from the big end, and Masak was equally vehement about the little end. All the debates were on a high and lofty intellectual level, verbally, but seemed absurd because of the simple fact that Saad and Masak always wore clown suits. The fourth day, they argued for and against abortion. The fifth day, for and against mercy killing. The sixth day, for and against the proposition, life is worth living. She became more and more aware of the time and money Hagbard had spent in training and preparing them. Each argued with the skill of a first-rate trial lawyer, and had a phalanx of carefully researched facts to support his position. And yet the clown suits made it hard to take either of them seriously. The seventh morning, they argued theism versus atheism. The eighth morning, the individual versus the state. The ninth, whether wearing shoes was or was not a sexual perversion. All arguments begin to seem equally insubstantial. The 10th morning, they feuded over realism versus antinomianism. The 11th, whether the statement, all statements are relative, is or is not self-contradictory. The 12th, whether a man who sacrifices his life for his country is or is not insane. The 15th, whether spaghetti or Dante had a greater influence on the Italian national character. But that was only the start of the day. After breakfast in her bedroom, where every article of furniture was gold, but only vaguely rounded, she went to Hagbard's study, where everything looked exactly like a golden apple, and watched documentary films concerning the early matriarchal stage of Greek culture. At 10 random intervals, the name Eris would be called. If she remembered to respond, a chocolate candy arrived from a wall chute. At 10 other random intervals, her own name was called. If she responded to this, she received a mild electric shock. After the 10th day, the system was changed and intensified. The shock was stronger if she responded to her previous name, whereas if she responded to Eris, Hagbard immediately entered and bawled her. During lunch, which always ended with a golden apple strudel, Gally and Eichmann danced for her, a complex ballet which Hagbard called hodgepodge. As many times as she saw this, she never was able to determine how they changed costumes at the climax, in which Hodge became Podge and Podge became Hodge. In the afternoon, Hagbard came to her suite and gave lessons in yoga, concentrating on pranayama with some training in asana.
The important thing is not being able to stand so still that you can balance a saucer of sulfuric acid on your head without getting hurt,
he stressed.
The important thing is knowing what each muscle is doing if it must be doing something.
In the evenings, they went to a small chapel that had been part of the villa for centuries. Hagbard had removed all Christian decorations and redesigned it in classical Greek, with a traditional magic pentagram on the floor. She sat, in the full lotus, within the internal pentagon, while Hagbard danced insanely around the 5 points, he was totally stoned, calling upon Eris.
Some of what you're doing seems scientific,
she told him after 5 days.
But some is plain damn foolishness.
If the science fails,
he replied,
the damn foolishness may work.
But last night you had me in that pentagon for 3 hours while you called on Eris, and she didn't come.
She will,
Hagbard said darkly.
Before the month is over. We're just establishing the foundation this week, laying down the proper lines of word and image and emotional energy.
During the second week, she was convinced Hagbard was quite mad as she watched him prance and caper like a goat around the 5 points, shouting,
Eo Eris! Eo Eris! Eris!
In the flickering candlelight and amid the heavy bouquet of burning incense and hemp. But at the end of that week, she was responding to her former name exactly 0% of the time and responding to Eris exactly 100% of the time.
The conditioning is working better than the magic,
she said on the 15th day.
Do you really think there's a difference?
He asked curiously. That night, she felt the air in the chapel change in a strange way during his dancing invocations.
Something's happening,
she said involuntarily, but he replied only,
quiet,
and continued more loudly and insanely to call upon Eris. The phenomenon, the tingle, remained, but nothing else happened.
What was it?
She asked later.
Some call it Orgon, and some call it the Holy Ghost,
he said briefly.
Weishaupt called it the Astral Light. The reason the Order is so fucked up is that they lost contact with it.
The following days, Saad and Masak argued whether God was male or female, whether God was sexed at all or neutral, whether God was an entity or a verb, whether R. Buckminster Fuller really existed or was a technocratic solar myth, and whether human language was capable of containing truth. Nouns, adjectives, adverbs, all parts of speech were losing meaning for her as these clowns endlessly debated the basic axioms of ontology and epistemology. Meanwhile, she was no longer rewarded for answering to the name Eris, but only for acting like Eris, the imperious and somewhat nutty goddess of a people as far gone in matriarchy as the Jews were in patriarchy. Hagbard, in turn, became so submissive as to border on masochism.
This is ridiculous,
she objected once.
You're becoming effeminate.
Eris can be somewhat adjusted to modern notions of decorum after we've invoked her,
he said calmly.
First, we must have her here. My lady,
he added obsequiously.
I'm beginning to see why you had to pick an actress for this,
she said a few days later, after a bit of method business had won her an extra reward. She was, in fact, beginning to feel like Eris as well as act like her.
The only other candidates, if I couldn't get you, were 2 other actresses and a ballerina,
he replied.
Actually, any strong-willed woman would do, but it would take much longer without previous theatrical training.
Books about matriarchy began to supplement the films. Diners, Mothers and Amazons, Bacoffin, Engels, Mary Renault, Morgan, Ian Suddy's The Origins of Love and Hate, Robert Graves in Horse Doctor's Doses, The White Goddess, The Black Goddess, Hercules My Shipmate, Watch the North Wind Rise. She began to see that matriarchy made as much sense as patriarchy. Hagbard's exaggerated deference toward her began to appear natural. She was far gone on a power trip. The invocations grew wilder and more frantic. Sod and Massac were brought into the chapel to assist with demonic music performed on a tom-tom and an ancient Greek pipe. They ate hashish cakes before the invocation now, and she couldn't remember afterward exactly what had happened. The voice of the male called upward to her.
Mother, creator, ruler, come to me. Io, Eris, come to me. Io, Eris, Eris, come to me. Ave Discordia, Ave Magna Mater, Venerandum Vente Vente. Io, Eris, Elandras, Io, Eris, Elepcalis. Thou bornless, ever reborn one, thou deathless, ever dying one, come to me as Isis, and Artemis, and Aphrodite, come as Helen, as Hera, come especially as Ares.
She was bathing in the rock pool when he appeared, the blood of slain deer and rabbits on his robe. She spoke the word, and Hagbard was stricken. As he fell forward, his hands became hooves, antlers sprouted from his head. His own dogs could eat him, she didn't care. The hemp smell in the room was gagging her, the tom-tom beat was maddening. She was rising out of the waves, proud of her nudity, riding on the cum-colored pearls of foam. He was carrying her back to bed, murmuring,
"My lady, my lady."
She was the hag, wandering the long Nile, weeping, seeking the fragments of his lost body as they passed the closet and the window. He placed her head gently on the pillow.
"We almost made it,"
he said.
"Tomorrow night, maybe."
They were back in the chapel. A whole day must have passed, and she sat immobile in full lotus, doing the pranayama breathing, while he danced and chanted. And the weird music of the pipe and the tom-tom worked on her every conditioned reflex that told her she was not American but Greek, not of this age but of a past age, not woman but goddess. The white light came as a series of orgasms and stars going nova. She half felt the body of light coming forth from the body of fire, and all three of them were sitting by her bed, watching her gravely as sunlight came flowing through the window. Her first word was crude and angry.
"Shit. Is it always going to be like that? A white epileptic spasm and a hole in time? Won't I ever be able to remember it?"
Hagbard laughed.
"Ha ha! I put on my trousers one leg at a time,"
he said.
"And I don't pull the corn up by its stalks to help it grow."
"Can the Taoism and give me a straight answer?"
"Remembering is just a matter of smoothing the transitions,"
he said.
"Yes, you'll remember. And control it."
"You're a madman,"
she replied wearily.
"And you're leading me into your own mad universe. I don't know why I still love you."
"We love him, too,"
Sod interjected helpfully.
"And we don't know why, either. We don't even have sex as an excuse."
Hagbard lit one of his foul Sicilian cigars.
"You think I just laid my trip on your head,"
he said.
"It's more than that, much more. Eris is an eternal possibility of human nature. She exists quite apart from your mind or mine, and she is the one possibility that the Illuminati cannot cope with. What we started here last night, with Pavlovian conditioning that's considered totalitarian, and ancient magic that's believed to be mere superstition, will change the course of history and make real liberty and real rationality possible at last. Maybe this dream of mine is madness, but if I lay it on enough people, it will be sanity by definition, because it will be statistically normal. We've just started with me programming the trip for you. The next step is for you to become a self-programmer."
"And he told the truth,"
Stella said.
"I did become a self-programmer. The three that you know were all my creations, possibilities within me, women I could have become anyway, if genes and environment had been only slightly different. Just small adjustments in the biogram and logogram.
Holy Mother,
George said hollowly. It seemed the only appropriate comment.
The only other detail?
She went on calmly.
Was arranging a convincing suicide. That took a while, but it was done, and my old identity officially ceased to exist.
She changed to her original form.
Oh, no,
George said, reeling.
It can't be. I used to jack off over pictures of you when I was a little boy.
Are you disappointed that I'm so much older than you thought?
Her eyes crinkled in amusement. He looked into those suddenly 30,000-year-old eyes of one manifestation of Lilith Elcor, and all the arguments of Sod and Masak appeared clownish. And he looked through those eyes and saw himself and Joe and Saul and even Hagbard as mere men, and all their attitudes as merely manly. And he saw the eternal womanly rebuttal, and he saw beyond and above that the eternal divine amusement. He looked into those eyes of amusement, those ancient glittering eyes so gay, and he said sincerely,
Hell, I can never be disappointed about anything, ever again.
George Dorn entered Nirvana, parenthetically. All categories collapsed, including the all-important distinction, which Masak and Sod had never argued, between science fiction and serious literature.
No. Because Daddy and Mommy were always just that, Daddy and Mommy. And never once did they become, for a change, Mommy and Daddy. Do you dig that important difference? Do you dig difference? Do you dig the lonely voice when you're lost out here shouting, Me. Me. Just me.
I can never be disappointed about anything, ever again,
George Dorn said, coming back.
The only other time that happened,
he added thoughtfully,
the only other time I had the feminine viewpoint, I blocked it out of my memory. That was my repression. That was the primal scene in this whole puzzle. That was when I really lost identity with the Ringmaster.